the intellectuals of the New Age. I couldn't believe that anyone who wrote these articles understood what Noboru Wataya was saying in his book. I had doubts whether they had even opened it. But such things were of no concern to them. Noboru Wataya was young and single and smart enough to write a book that nobody could understand. It made him famous. The magazines all came to him for critical pieces. He appeared on television to comment on political and economic questions. Soon he was a regular panel member on one of the political debate shows. Those who knew Noboru Wataya, including Kumiko and I, had never imagined him to be suited to such glamorous work. Everyone thought of him as a highly strung academic type, interested in nothing but his field of specialization. Once he got a taste of the world of mass media, though, you could almost see him licking his chops. He was good. He didn't mind having a camera pointed at him. If anything, he even seemed more relaxed in front of the cameras than in the real world. We watched his sudden transformation with amazement. The Noboru Wataya we saw on television wore expensive suits with perfectly matching ties and glasses with frames of fine tortoiseshell. His hair had been done in the latest style. He'd obviously been worked on by a professional. I'd never seen him exuding such luxury before, and even if he had been outfitted by the network, he wore the style with perfect ease, as if he had dressed that way all his life. Who was this man? I wondered when I first saw him. Where was the real Noboru Wataya? In front of the cameras, he played the role of man of few words. When asked for an opinion, his response would be simple, clear, and precise. Whenever the debate heated up and everyone else was shouting, he kept his cool. When challenged, he would hold back, let his opponent have his say, and then demolish the person's argument with a single phrase. He had mastered the art of delivering the fatal blow with a purr and a smile. On the television screen, he looked far more intelligent and reliable than the real Noboru Wataya. I'm not sure how he accomplished this. He certainly wasn't handsome, but he was tall and slim and had an air of good breeding. In the medium of television, Noboru Wataya had found the place where he belonged. The mass media welcomed him with open arms, and he welcomed them with equal enthusiasm. Meanwhile, I couldn't stand the sight of him, in print or on TV. He was a man of talent and ability, to be sure. I recognized that much. He knew how to knock his opponent down quickly and effectively with the fewest possible words. He had an animal instinct for sensing the direction of the wind, but if you paid close attention to what he was saying or what he had written, you knew that his words lacked consistency. They reflected no single world view based on profound conviction. His was a world that he had fabricated by combining several one-dimensional systems of thought. He could rearrange the combination in an instant, as needed. These were ingenious, even artistic, intellectual permutations and combinations. But to me, they amounted to nothing more than a game. If there was any consistency to his opinions, it was the consistent lack of consistency. And if he had a worldview, it was a view that proclaimed his lack of a worldview. But these very absences were what constituted his intellectual assets. Consistency and an established worldview were excess baggage in the intellectual mobile warfare that flared up in the mass media's tiny time segments. And it was his great advantage to be free of such things. He had nothing to protect, which meant that he could concentrate all his attention on pure acts of combat. He needed only to attack, to knock his enemy down. Noboru Wataya was an intellectual chameleon, changing his color in accordance with his opponents, ad-libbing his logic for maximum effectiveness, mobilizing all the rhetoric at his command. I had no idea how he had acquired these techniques, but he clearly had the knack of appealing directly to the feelings of the mass audience. He knew how to use the kind of logic that moved the majority. Nor did it even have to be logic. It had only to appear so, as long as it aroused the feelings of the masses. Trotting out the technical jargon was another forte of his. No one knew what it meant, of course, but he was able to present it in such a way that you knew it was your fault if you didn't get it. And he was always citing statistics. They were engraved on his brain, and they carried tremendous persuasive power. But if you stop